I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Positive the People. In this episode, it's me, Diara, Miles, and Kaya talking about the news that you don't know with regard to race and justice over the past week, news that you might not have heard, and we obviously talk about the election. Don't forget to follow us at Positive the People on Instagram. Here we go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I'm Diara Ballinger. You can find me at Diara Ballinger on Instagram.
I'm Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
Oh my gosh, where am I? I'm Kaya Henderson. I used to be at Henderson Kaya on Twitter, and now I'm just out here roaming around.
I'm DeRay at DRAY on Twitter and on Blue Sky, and I am DeRay on Instagram. Y'all, the digital spaces are getting shakier and shakier.
Well, that's not all that shaky, DeRay.
Wait, before we get to shaky, can I just give a positive shout out? I want to start us on, we're coming off of Thanksgiving, so much to be thankful for. But I last weekend was at the Black Male Educators Convening in Philadelphia. 1,200 African-American male educators and people who love and support them in the house. And there was so much love for Pod Save the People. As I walked through the hallways, all of those brothers and sisters were like, hey, I listened to the podcast. Oh my gosh, I love the podcast. You've been off the podcast. Tell Miles hi. Hey, hey, Diara. Hey, DeRay. It was just so much love in that space for us. And it reminded me, first of all, that people listen, because I usually just think, oh yeah, every Monday morning I get to chit chat with my friends and I forget that there are lots of people actually listening to us. But it reminded me of how important this conversation is to our community, to the people who are educating our young people. So I wanted y'all to share that warm, fuzzy feeling with me this morning before we get started.
And you know what, Kai, I'm gonna keep it going, because the last time I was in Philadelphia, it was working on Kamala Harris's campaign. Oh boy.
There are other good things happening in Philly.
But I love Philadelphia, and I stayed at a hotel called Yowie Hotel. Miles, I'm going to take you there. It's owned by a sister named Shannon Maldonado, and it is a beautiful, beautifully designed and curated space. And so the trauma that was Philly election night for me, at least I was in a very beautiful place that was curated and done up by a Black woman. So shout out to Shannon.
Oh, it's designed by a Black woman?
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool.
So shout out to
Philly. Philly is hot. Philly, don't sleep on Philly.
I love Philly, and it's my favorite place to run. Okay, so speaking of all that Black excellence, let's move to Kendrick and Drake.
Oh, yes.
That laugh. Yeah, Miles is our resident culture expert.
And Miles, break it, please. Well, I want to set it up, because essentially, you know, there's also, I feel like my entry point to this is still, I'm still having a hard time with Super Bowl in New Orleans and Kendrick performing over, like, that's still where I am with Kendrick Lamar. Also, Kendrick Lamar just had an album drop. And last week, Drake launched this legal action against Universal Music, accusing the label and Kendrick Lamar of sort of like boosting the streams of Not Like Us. So that paperwork has been filed. he is alleging illegal scheme involving bots, payola. I love the word payola. You know why I love it? From Dreamgirls, when they were accusing the Jamie Foxx character of payola in Dreamgirls. I love when Black people say words. It's just the best thing ever. but that's what I got. So, Miles, what is your perspective on this?
My immediate perspective is that Drake is a loser. but like now, like the loserness is like deepening as things are going on. So what's really interesting is, you're right, Diara. Some people are really upset about Kendrick Lamar performing at Louisiana. Most of those people are Louisiana rappers, Lil Wayne, people like that. But first of all, it's the 11th time that the Super Bowl has been in Louisiana. So there were other times that that could have happened where it would have been more appropriate to maybe center Lil Wayne's stardom. And then to put that on top of that, you know, the Super Bowl is about making money. They sell everything. It's a big old commercial. So nobody specifically in rap has captured this kind of mass attention than Kendrick Lamar and Drake because of this beef. Like, where's the last time we don't do it for award shows anymore. We don't do it for performances. We really rarely come together as a community around entertainment and music events anymore. So it was iconic and it was a good business decision to do. The thing about Drake suing is crazy. The thing about Drake suing is wild, because not only is it just like losery, like, you know, like, oh my God, he did payola, he did all these different things or whatever, but I don't know what Drake is sipping, but you know how like sometimes you have a fine friend and then they don't understand how come they got broken up with? And it was like, that man was not with you because of your personality. That man was with you because of your body. That man was with you because of your sex appeal. I'm like, these numbers were not because of you were so talented and gifted, sir. There were some white men who put their tokens behind you and said, this Black Jewish man right here.
It took me a minute, but I am there. I'm fully there.
You know, I'm not going to break it down to
Miles got the setup of setups for these days.
I was trying to break it down to like myself. I was like, no, like Drake, you're automatically putting the light on you because we know that you benefited from these same things. We know that you have participated in payola and streaming and all the ways you
that's
can.
That's how you know what to sue about.
Inflate things. And that's how you know what to sue about. And then just the last thing that I'll say about it, which is like, obviously this is culture, so it feels cultural, but it's just so the opposite way that you handle losing a rap battle.
Exactly.
Like, being litigious is not the way that you do it. Yeah, I'm exactly. Like, Drake, you if there's any place that you don't want a liberal elite, you do not want to be litigious with the person from Cali who's rapping you and say, you know what, I don't like how this went, I'm going to sue. No. But that's what he did, so...
Oh, Miles. Miles.
He might have a political future because he seems like he fits in other spaces.
I am so with you. I was like, do you understand the origins of rap? The origins of rap are about people beefing with each other. And right. Your comeback is a rap song, Drake.
Right.
But since you don't write your own raps and you are not really as talented as this other brother is, you gonna sue? That's like calling the principal on somebody. Are you kidding me? What in the world? I mean, what? I mean, laid out, stunned. First of all, that little Kendrick album is hot to death. I sat in my hotel room and listened to the whole thing in one clip. Oh my gosh. I deserve it all. That's my new theme song for the next 12 months, friends.
I deserve it all.
And then to see this lawsuit drop, I was like, Drake, you're not doing yourself no favors out here, boo. There is nobody in the world who is going to support this. Are you kidding me? But you're right, Miles. You are absolutely right. You know this stuff because this is how you got put on. And the streets cannot be for this, right? I'm not in the streets no more. I'm an auntie, but the streets can't be for this.
Can't be. And just the last thing about the for me about the Kendrick Lamar album, because I didn't get to touch that. That album is brilliant. I think that he captured. What's interesting is like Kendrick Lamar usually infuses jazz and funk, and I think there is a automatic, reflective, and retrospective feeling in Kendrick Lamar's music, because he takes things from Jill Scott Heron and poetry and jazz and funk, and he kind of combines that. This album is a breakthrough. So there's some jams on it that are hard, but it feels paranoid. It feels conspiratorial. It feels he's like, the even the sounds that are like very like glitchy. It feels like this moment, and I'm like, he might be a prophet. I think God told him Negroes need this. Mike Tyson got beat up. Mike Tyson got beat up.
Mike Tyson didn't get beat up. Mike Tyson earned himself $20 million.
Mike Tyson got paid. Mm. But the meme of Kamala and Mike Tyson was
shaking his head like that.
That was funny. Like that.
We didn't need that image of Mike Tyson getting hit by no young man right after Kamala lost. That's what I'm saying.
That could be, but the brother needed some cash and he wasn't made to make it.
Oh, we need a GoFundMe for Mike.
I will say, the other thing about the Drake lawsuit is, you know, my best friend Trey, so the moment it drops, he goes, you suing for this? You're not suing because he called you a pedophile? Like, if you're going to sue for something, sue for, you know, because he's making some claims that have actually ruined your career, not because people are listening to you, just a diss track. And then what does Drake do? He turns around and sues for defamation. And you're like, also, don't do that, actually. Don't like that. You look nuts, especially when you've made all these claims about Kendrick. It's not like your hands are clean in this either. You talked about his kid not being his manager doing all this other crazy stuff. Now, what I do love too is that Kendrick and team have tapped into the culture moment, because all the brands tweeting out and putting up billboards for mustard.
Oh,
is
yes, Heinz, brilliant.
It's
brilliant.
Like, you can't buy that. Now, that's, he didn't right. buy that. That's not payola. That's just cultural mm-hmm. currency. And he got that.
I think the other thing that it has done, I don't know about you all, because I work out and run a lot, and a lot of my playlists have Drake songs, because there are a lot of bops. But I find myself skipping any time a Drake, it's almost like it's starting to be in the same sort of music vault that I don't go to anymore, along with some other artists that I will not name. But it's like, that's what has happened to me sort of like psychologically. Like, a Drake song will come on and I'll be like, ooh, I can't. Mm-mm. And I press skip. So it's an interesting thing.
You have to think about those consultants that are around Drake. I think there's such a through line with Drake as like cultural president of hip hop for so long. Right. But do you have to look at the and how we talk about the presidency and the consultants around them? You know, these superstars have the same consultants, the same people who are supposed to have their ears to the streets and be able to do things. And he is so interesting, because in front of our eyes, Drake went from trendy to archaic, because he actually is representing a type of hip hop that is gone. Even Kendrick Lamar releasing a song called "The Party Is Over," the Diddy arrest. It seems like the kind of hip-hop that Drake has wrote on has just totally died, and it's like nobody told Drake. So he's still bling bling, I can take your hoe, and he's still pouring Cristal, but you're like, the common people seem like they were ready to revolt, so maybe we shouldn't be as flashy anymore. But Drake didn't get that memo. Mm-hmm. Maybe he didn't get the mail in Canada or something.
It's a little bit like the Democratic Party being out of touch with where the people
that's
are.
What the through line I was trying that was the through line I was trying
come on and make the connection come on and make the connection
that was the through line I was creating.
Everybody, connection made.
I'm just saying it for the people who are a little slow like me, that's all.
Well, that's the perfect time to transition to Hunter Biden being pardoned by his daddy. Okay, so
I am deeply interested in your take on
well,
this.
My take is this. It is upsetting. It's upsetting because this is not, this man is not Leonard Peltier. He's not a Shada Shakur. People who are still either incarcerated or on an FBI most wanted list. This is somebody who did crack, had a gun, threw it in a dumpster. And then, like, it is, it's like sort of the craziest crackish crimes that he is guilty of. And now, and also this sort of behavior in prosecution, and you know, obviously setting aside like addiction politics, and I get that part of it, but it's almost, it certainly didn't help Joe Biden's campaign, this whole trial that went on for weeks and weeks. He was convicted and now he's being pardoned. And I just feel like, one, the Democrats are sort of laying the groundwork for what Trump will do around pardoning all kinds of tomfoolery. And two, it's like, what kind of signal are you sending just in terms of your legacy? Because he did these crimes. He did them. It's not, you know, he wasn't over sentenced. He wasn't over prosecuted. For me, a pardon is something that happens if one, the government is somehow at fault for what the prosecution was. And there's evidence to show that you weren't, that you hadn't committed the crimes that you were accused of. It's to me, the pardoning process is never just like, if the pardoning process is this, it is sort of dictatorial. It is. So we're going to, you did the crime, but okay, whatever. We're going to let you go. No worries. I don't know. That's I'm all over the place, but that's sort of where I'm at with it.
if you can, because this is not usually a visual podcast.
Go ahead.
Me and Auntie Kaya literally were, one was Serena and I was Venus, I guess, and we were just bobbing our eyes like, who gonna take it? The thing is, like, you know, this is something a corrupt government would do. And I think you have to see the. So my thing, maybe a little bit too much information around certain things. But my whole thing is, I don't ever believe in kind of the fantasy I've been seeing people have in interviews around a lot of people who vote for Trump, like, awakening. I like, you know, and I think that the red pilled idea is good. Like, you are red pilled. You cannot go back. The metaphor with the Matrix is true. Once you have been successfully, once your mind has successfully bended in the way that you vote for Trump, I'm not convinced that a significant enough people would change their minds on that. I'm just not. What I am convinced of is that enough people who do not vote, who feel totally abandoned by the system, can be motivated to vote. But now you have a situation like this where it's like, we know Trump's gonna do something dirty. We already know, he already told us. He said, you know what? If your uncle or your meemaw is in jail because they came and stormed that Capitol, I'm getting meemaw out in Christmas 2025, he's gonna be out. Yes. And we say, and people say that is corrupt. But then what Biden does is says, I'm not going to do that. I'm totally going to let the system happen. It doesn't matter if it's my own son, because I'm a Democrat president who is old school and has dignity and goes by the rules. I'm not going to do that because I'm so different than Trump. And then you do the same thing, but with a letter and a press release. So I think that is like that's the basis of the confusion for a lot of people. And not even confusion. That's the basis of the depression of a lot of people. A lot of people who are not getting up to go do anything. And I wish that, you know, I don't believe nobody should be in jail for doing a little crack. I don't think nobody should be in jail for having a bad day. You already know, so I already say free Hunter all day, and let Hunter be out, because you ain't never been through something. You know what that family's been through. You go do some a little crack too, see if it helped. But I also think this couldn't be paired. And in all seriousness, I think it, like, in my head, I'm thinking this couldn't be paired with something that is also communal. Like, we couldn't do this and release people who have weed sentences. And I know he could eventually do that, but I'm like, why even give people the energy to make this an independent thing? Like, do it at the same time. So in order to talk about this story, you have to talk about this too. You're not even giving us anything to talk about, Biden. You just, what?
But also, Miles, this happened over Thanksgiving, right? So yeah. The Biden family's at the Thanksgiving table. Like, this, There's so, so many things to talk about.
Can I get in? Okay.
Please.
So first of all, let me be very clear. If I was the president, I would pardon my child. Period. The end. It ain't no two ways about it, especially when Mr. Trump is about to let all of these legitimate criminals who stormed the Capitol out of jail. He's going to let them all out of jail. He's going to pardon them. The least I'm going to do is take care of my baby who has a little crack problem.
And a tax evasion problem. A major tax evasion problem.
A little crack problem is crazy.
Wait a minute. Guess what? Mr. Trump just appointed Jared Kushner's father to something or another who went to jail for tax evasion and a bunch of other things.
These are the same Democratic campaigns that will not let Black folks who have tax liens pass vet.
So here's what I'm saying to you. I think that the Democrats have to rethink their strategies, right? Like, you can't be right and be right and lose and be right and whatever. You got to do some things differently. And so, number one, as a parent, I would pardon my son. Now, what I wouldn't have said is, I'm going to let the thing play itself out or blah, 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 because I would have always had this ace in my pocket and I would have just been quiet with it. Let the thing play out and then pardon my son. Sorry, that's just what I would do. A, number one. B, number two, I think Miles is absolutely right in that if you were going to pardon, you could have made this an issue. You could have coupled this with something that you could win on, right? I don't think it's going to tarnish his legacy. People are going to talk about it as well as a number of other things. But I mean, this to me is another one of those times where we're like, well, he should do the right thing. This dude don't have nothing to lose. It's over. I would be much more radical. I would be issuing an executive order for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day between now and January 20th. I would try to push everything that I possibly could. I'm interested in his whole making Ozempic and weight loss drugs coverable by Medicaid. I think Medicaid and Medicare, I think that has tremendous health implications for 100 million people who could use those drugs, who don't have access to those drugs. And we'll see, because it requires a 60-day comment period, whether or not Mr. Trump holds that, when a lot of Mr. Trump's supporters are going to need those medicines and the rest of the insurance industry will follow Medicaid and Medicare. I think that it is important for him to be doing as much as he possibly can. This one is a gimme. Like, everybody is going to, I mean, the people that Mr. Trump are putting up who have all kinds of questionable, I mean, he's not pardoning Hunter Biden so that Hunter Biden could be the next ambassador to France or the head of the FBI. He's letting his baby out of jail. And I think I don't think that that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I think we are about to be in super crazydom. And this is going to pale in comparison. We're not even going to talk about this in 6 months when the chaos and mayhem is raining down all over us.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is, you know, this is where I think the disconnect between the consultant class and people on their couches is that I do think there's like a political wisdom that is playing by this rule book and trying to figure out what the message on MSNBC is going to be and what the pundits are going to say. And I think if that is the audience you're catering to, a lot of the Biden decisions make total sense to me. The challenge is that that's just not the world we're in. The MSNBC does not control the news cycle anymore. CNN does not control the news cycle anymore, like the internet does, or, you know, it's people in their homes. And that means you actually have to talk to people in a way they understand. Because if Biden had said, hey, Trump has made it really clear he is going to attack my family when he gets in office. He said it in public. He said it in private. He said it again and again, that Cash, the guy that he's going to put in the FBI, has said publicly, I'm going to go after everybody who supported him, including the family. He said it. So Biden could say, you know what? I didn't want to pardon him. I think he pled guilty. It wasn't even like Hunter. Hunter pled guilty. Biden could say, my son pled guilty. And I am ashamed that he did those things. And I hope that he grows. And I'm pardoning him so that he does not become a pawn of the Trump administration. I think people in their couches would be like, that makes sense to me. Now, MSNBC, I don't know what they'd say, but I do think that people in their couches would be like, I get it, because that Trump is crazy. So that's like one thing. The second thing I'd say is that what the left, I think, does not get, and Miles, I think your read is completely right. I think we're not going to get those Trump people. But there are a lot of people on our side who are choosing not to participate because they're like, the whole thing's screwed. is that I think that the left does not get that, like, the right people are values voters, and they're sort of like values of the V voters. So, like, you got to lead with the values. The right people are power voters, and they sort of, values be damned. They sort of are like, just make sure our person wins. And talking to the two groups is really different. And I feel like sometimes the left is trying to play to the base of the right. That's how I feel about Liz Cheney. I get the need to say, like, you know, we build a big tent and da-da-da. But we know that our values and Liz's have not aligned in the past. It's a values things. But if you are trying to just have raw power, the Liz Cheney makes total sense. But that doesn't animate our base. That makes people think that we're no better than the other side. And that, to me, is where I think that the disconnect comes in. It's like what Miles said in this podcast, but we've all said on different ones. And I think the Hunter Biden thing, and, you know, he's only pardoned, what, 26 people. Biden did do that big pardon of almost 3,000 people for a low level marijuana. It doesn't immediately sort of release them, but it does set them up so that they won't have as intense consequences. That's a big deal. But again, like, in not wrapping this up with other pardons of people who are legitimately need some clemency, he could take everybody off death row. He could do that. Trump is saying, I'm gonna kill everybody. He's already said that. Biden could do that, and he didn't. And again, I think this is what happens when you get a type of leader who's been around for a long time playing to the wrong moment, playing to the wrong crowd and to the wrong media. And I think that is hard. Now, what I don't like is people like Nate Silver getting online being like, any Democrat who doesn't disavow this should not be. And you're like, y'all, Lita, you did not have any of that energy for Trump. You ain't have none of, you weren't doing any of these backflips when Trump was doing all types of stuff. I think it is, I'm not interested in like pure outrage as if this is like the wildest thing that's ever happened.
I agree with everything y'all all are saying. And I think the part where I'm at, where I'm just still in sort of process mode post this campaign is like, I do feel, I think I am misaligned values wise, strategy wise with this party and have been for quite a long time. And I even was having a conversation with another friend of mine that's been in the game for a while and just saying how I'm often the disruptor in every campaign I'm in. And I think when I saw this headline, it was one of those things that I feel like had it come into my inbox that there was a meeting about this particular issue and what the advice should be, I think that this thing seems like it's sort of like this very well-organized machine that is playing to this audience or MSNBC, but it's often not. It's often people who are making one very urgent decision in the midst of making 10 to 20 other urgent decisions. So it's not actually as thought out as you think, something like this should be. And so in that, I think pulling back to being like, as a party, like, what are our values with the leaders of the Democratic Party? What are their values, and what can I find to hang onto? And I think when I saw this headline, I didn't relate to it at all. I'm as somebody who has studied so many political prisoners that have been in jail my whole lifetime, and to know that they're still be sitting in jail after we've had, I don't know how many Democratic presidents now, understanding that, you know, President Clinton also pardoned his brother for some, you know, cocaine distribution shit in the 90s. I'm just like, for me, I guess where I'm at is enough, and I'm sick of bullshit. And to y'all's point around, like, if you are going to pardon some people, like, make it a pardon package and put some people in there that actually made sense, who had given their lives and who their children have given their lives as part of a movement. But I guess for me, that I can't trivialize this, because to me it speaks to sort of a greater values question around these people and around these people that are still running our country and still have, you know, some weeks in office to do a lot. But they're not, because they're sitting around their Thanksgiving table talking about what's going to happen to Uncle Hunter. I don't care. Like, there are people, Miles, to your point last week, there are people suffering. And that's what y'all talking about at Thanksgiving? Because either way, y'all going to be all right. Whether Trump comes after them or they're going to be just fine. So I don't know. That's where maybe I need to send Nate an email. Maybe I am outraged by it. I am who you all are speaking.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So my news was fascinating to me. It's out of the Washington Post this week. And the title of the article is Inside the Effort to Market Russia and Putin's to Russia and Putin to Africans. And it talks about this organization called the African Initiative, which is a pro-Russian group that's advertising on television and newspapers and online in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso is a West African country with about 23 million people, I think. And the African Initiative is an opaque network of groups that the Kremlin uses to spread Russian influence in Africa. It's based in Moscow, and they have excelled in marketing themselves all over Africa, but most notably in West Africa, which is experiencing a lot of violence and disruption from Islamic extremists, and where military strongmen have overthrown many of the governments that were seen as close to the West. And the African Initiative is actually marketing to African audiences with a mix of pro-Russian and pan-Africanist messages. They tell the story of a school founder, a young man who who starts a new school. And when the school needed blackboards and notebooks for his new school, he knew who to call because he had seen these commercials on TV and online and in newspapers about the African Initiative. And so he called the African Initiative. And of course, they sent him a slew of blackboards and notebooks for his kids. And each notebook had a photo of Burkina Faso's interim president, hands clasped with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And the school children are screaming hooray for the interim president and hooray for Vladimir Putin. People say things like, when Burkina Faso needs help, Russia steps up. Russia has provided arms and training in the fight against Islamic extremists for Burkina Faso and other West African governments. In addition to talking about the amazing things that Russia is doing, they also are undermining a lot of the U.S.-funded public health projects across Africa to basically sort of destabilize the African relationship with the United States and the West, and to shift the balance of power to have closer relationships with the Kremlin. They do things like they host events to promote friendship between Russia and Western African countries. They sponsor Russian martial arts competitions. They have free Russian movie showings. They have raffles with expensive prizes to attract followers to their social media channels. They have created opportunities, more and more opportunities for African students to go study in Russia. And a lot of this has happened after the war in Ukraine, since Russia has become increasingly isolated and strapped for resources. Where in the world has the most resources? Africa. And so Africa has grown more and more important for the Kremlin. And I just thought, I mean, they even highlighted a man who sells motorcycles and raises chickens for a living, just a regular Burkina Fasan, who professes an unconditional love for Russia. And I thought this was really, really fascinating. For those people who don't know, the vast majority of the world's natural resources, remaining natural resources, are in Africa. The vast majority of the world's employable population of young people under 25, Africa has the largest population of young people under 25. And if you have not been paying attention to what's been going on in Africa, people from the West have been buying up, literally. I went to Nigeria, Miles, speaking of Nigeria, in 2019, and I saw more Chinese people than I would have ever expected to see in Africa. And the Chinese people are building roads and they're doing infrastructure projects and they own shopping malls and whatever. And we're watching the we're not even watching it. It's happening sort of under our noses. We're watching the recolonization of Africa because we have resources, in part aided and assisted by some African governments that are capitalizing on the opportunity. But I think that given Russia's unique position right now in the world, where it is engaged in a war with Ukraine, which is also a very resource-rich country, and that's part of the reason why they invaded it, where it is interfering geopolitically in not just in the United States elections, but in governments all over the world, and given Africa's unique positioning, I just thought this is one to keep your eye open for, folks, because while we are arguing about whether Hunter Biden should go to jail or not, our cousins over on the other side of the ocean are talking about unconditional love for Russia, which I don't think is going to bode well for the rest of us. So I brought this here because I thought we should be aware of it and wondered what you thought.
I think often people, so you know, like when you do, when we like vote nationally and there's like the red states and the blue states, I often think that we should also do that for the globe. Because I think sometimes we don't understand, what's weird about this particular moment because of the internet, I think sometimes we don't understand how conservative the whole world is and how red the whole world is. And what's scary about this to me is when I think about Israel underneath their leadership, when I think about India underneath their leadership, and then also when I think about Africa, that's one of the reasons I remember we pods and pods and pods and scores ago, we talked about the trip to Ghana, and we talked about Black people's some Black people's excitement about that trip to Ghana. And my pushback was, what about LGBT rights, and what about all the ways that LGBT and queer people will be in danger, because a lot of countries, including Ghana, are deeply conservative and align closer than we would like to admit with places like Russia and places like China and culturally. And a lot of these things, when you look at how we're seen, how liberalism is seen, how progressivism is seen across the globe, it's really like, look at Biden and Kamala, and everybody in their society's all mixed up. They're born one way and they want to be another. Look at all these gay and trans spirits over there, and they don't know what to do. Meanwhile, they're all in danger. And I think this article, Auntie Kaya, had really reminded me how conservative the world is. And I think sometimes when you're in America, you can just think that this is our problem, but I'm like, no, like, Brexit is real. Like, this is a global conservatism, a global pushback, and a lot of people are more aligned than not. And we can't just look at people's skin color or even people's cultural histories and think we will be able to know what their decisions are going to be, specifically when it's progressivism versus conservatism, because conservatism will always hold power and people are going to side with power. So it makes, we can't just separate it, go, you're African or you have Black skin, so you're not going to be with Russia. It's like, no, they, conservatism empowers here, so people are going to be magnetic to that. So we have to figure out ways to, child, don't even get me started on figuring out ways. I don't know. Now I'll just be talking shit.
But I think, Miles, that's right. But it's also, this has been decades and decades of intervention by both Russia and China to establish these like relationships and bonds with the continent. When I was at the State Department, I did a ton of work in both West and East Africa. And what I was always sort of overwhelmed by, the amount of sort of investment in infrastructure, digital infrastructure that China was putting into Africa. And I just Googled, because I think this is like such a smart thing that China did. I Googled, where has China built stadiums, like football stadiums in Africa? And it's Angola, it's Benin, it's Burkina Faso, it's the Ivory Coast, it's Kenya, it's Tanzania. And this is part of a long-term plan for China to boost diplomatic ties through large-scale infrastructure projects. So this, it is, yes, like, you know, sort of where we are now is we're seeing this conservatism and we're seeing sort of these relationships and bonds being built on more conservative sort of principles and values. But this has been decades and decades in the making. And it's also been a sort of another issue with the United States government, because this is sort of, we are a country through our diplomacy has always undervalued and devalued our relationship with the continent. And for Black folks that have been in the Foreign Service for decades, this was always a thing in the Foreign Service, is that if you become a senior Foreign Service officer, you go to an African country if you're Black. You don't get a job in France. You don't get a job in the UK. You don't get a job anywhere else, right? And it's an interesting, it's an interesting thing, sort of what has happened because of bad diplomacy on the United States' behalf and the ignoring of this entire continent. Because here's where we are.
You know, it was helpful to see this in the Washington Post, because I do think, and my broader message is around what is real but gets deemed a conspiracy, or what is real and gets talked about in ways that are too complicated for people to understand, but the actual core message is not complicated. And I think that, you know, I'm even somebody really plugged in. Obviously, we've had the pod for a while, so I have to read the news every week. And the, like, Russia influence thing felt like the boogeyman for a long time. It was like people on Twitter were talking about it, some of the blogs were talking about it, but it wasn't like it was hard to wrap your hands around it. So I appreciate that, like, people are wrapping their hands around it in a way now that is lifting it up out of the, like, conspiracy theory land and into the, like, you know, Russia actually is methodically working on influencing a lot of things, both the election in the United States. As you remember, the DOJ talked about those podcasters who are making $400,000 an episode. You see Kaya's article talking about construction and da da da, right? Like this, there's a mapping of what Russia's doing that I appreciate and think is really important. I also think that, Miles, to your point around, like, you know, there's a lot of conservative people, I think that is true. And I like still, and this is, I really am not like a Pollyanna about it. I really do think that the base is actually with us on the core values when we talk about it in a certain way. And I think that the base is not when we talk about things in a different way. And I say that because I was talking to somebody I work with who is an organizer. And this is such a random example, but we're talking about gerrymandering. So I say something about gerrymandering and they say, like, I don't know what that means. Like, da 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 da. They do this whole, like, they are like, DeRay, this feels really complicated. Let's talk about something light. And I'm like, you do know what, you might not know what the word is, but you definitely know what the idea is, that, like, you know, people should represent people who live in their neighborhood. That makes sense. And gerrymandering means that we sort of make these random districts of people that don't live, that have nothing in common, but we do it so that they can elect a certain person. And she's like, that makes total sense. And we talk about prison gerrymandering, right? Which is like these, what happens when you count the prisoner, people incarcerated as the town to inflate the number of representatives. Anyway, I say this because I do think there's a way that we talk about all of this stuff, Russia, voter ID, gerrymandering, that like our side will be like, yes, that makes total sense. I believe it. And I don't think, that to me is not conservative or liberal. I think there's a way we can talk about the trans community, that we can talk about queer issues, healthcare, that like our people will get off the couch and be like, that's what I want. I believe it. I think that is not the way we're talking about these things. And I think that is beating our blah, blah, blah. I think there is a moral superiority in our messaging that is rough. But when I think about the Russia stuff, I do think we gotta, I appreciated, Kai, you bringing this, because for the first time, I saw something that like laid out the argument just very clear without this like conspiracy theory angle. And I think that that is actually really helpful. And I think that this is what people are interested in. And I, you know, I wanted to say too, you saw, did y'all see the historic drop off in viewers for MSNBC and CNN after the election?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Historic drop off. People like are just, yes, not watching MSNBC and CNN anymore. And the reason I think that matters is I do think that the coverage of the election was banking on what happened when Trump won the first time, which was like, we would watch all day. We were hooked in. It was fascinating and wild. And people aren't doing that anymore. People are like, I don't want to see this all day long. I don't want to, I'm checked out. I don't want to do the Trump drama train. And I say that because I think that it'll make our storytelling even more important. I think it'll make like aunts and uncles even more important as we go forward.
One thing that I wanted to do and what I want to start doing more on the podcast is maybe connecting things that I've read through traditional sources with how it's being channeled to different people via like news sources. So like, AKA, like getting something from, so I got this from UVA today. And then a YouTuber, a Black YouTuber who's brilliant by the name of Little Bill, ended up doing something that's very similar to this story in their year gap. But I would dare to say that this story or anything similar to it is probably not going to get the tracks that Little Bill's video will get. So I want to start just letting people and y'all and myself know and remind myself how people are getting their information. But today we are talking about the Black church. So I've been doing a lot of reflecting and a lot of thinking, and you know, Black folks are not going to church. Younger Black folks are not going to church. The memberships are just dropping. And we also know, specifically everybody on this podcast and probably anybody who's listening, that historically the Black church has been a way for political movements and organization and social organization to happen. And specifically, the younger you are, the more or less likely you are to go to church. And if you're Black, and the younger you are, it also means if you're going to vote or not. So a lot of people, when you start seeing the drops in Black people voting, it happens with younger people too. And I think there's some synergy there. I think there's some things to draw from. So I wanted to read a quote from, really an answer from this article that was really interesting to me. The question was, in your essay in the conversation, you quote some scholars as saying the Black church is defunct while others say it remains vibrant. What's your conclusion? The answer is, I believe that the Black church remains an influential religious and cultural institution despite its declining membership. It continues to shape the lives of many African Americans. At best, it provides a sense of belonging, community, power, and significance in the face of personal hardships and enduring systemic challenges. It is not only a site for the cultivation of Black religious expression, but also has contributed to both African American cultural expressions and American culture at large. Despite its remaining influence, it remains to be seen how African-American Christian churches will come to terms with growing distrust of religion among younger people. One of the longstanding critiques of Christianity by Black critics is that it is the white man's religion. Alongside this, many Black LGBTQ youth and women call out pervasive patriarchy, queer antagonism, and trans antagonism in many Black churches. Given the challenges to advances of women and LGBT rights in the United States from religious and political conservatives, these groups perceive conservative Black churches as colluding with these forces. And I think that has to be a big part of what Democrats and the liberal and the left, whatever the names are, have to think about, because the more I look at these numbers, they're really scary. I'm like, Black people, specifically younger Black people, are not voting. And when we do vote, we tout around how we always usually vote what we would want to say is the most logical way. But if we're kind of moving in where the people who are voting consistently and loyally are going to, not to be macabre, but are going to be dying, and there's going to be a whole nother generation of Black people who are not at all convinced or motivated to go vote, then that particular block is going to be eroding. And I don't think that only the middle class or upper middle class or the politically engaged Black person is going to be enough to keep that power in the Black vote. And I think it's because of that erosion in the Black church. And I'm thinking through ways like, what is the replacement of that? We always talk about third spaces and how I guess the narrative is that all Starbucks took away all of our third spaces. And, you know, a really important third space for Black people is the church. And it just seems as if that is just not true anymore. And as I was reading this, I've seen plenty. I implore everybody who's interested to go Google this, Al Sharpton and Democrats, or Al Sharpton taking money. So as this is happening, you have a whole bunch of Black people. These are people Black on the left. So these are either Bernie Sanders, independent people, but these are not Black conservatives. You have a lot of Black people seeing that And dissenting against Al Sharpton taking money and being upset that Al Sharpton was chosen to talk to Vice President Harris and did not disclose that he took money to speak to her, and that would influence how those interviews go. And when I was reading that particular quote about people, specifically younger people, specifically young queer people who are leaders in the Black community, feeling like, oh no, you are colluding with those forces. And then you have something like the Al Sharpton story drop, which for a lot of people reinforces the idea that yes, the Black church, Black leadership, people who are from that civil rights era or class of people are now colluding with Democratic forces for their own political gain. And I think this last election has shown the consequences of such erosion in that framework. And I wanted to bring it here, not because I have any specific answers, but I wanted to see, what do we think should be a third place? Do we see things like erecting itself in their place that we can empower? Is there any space for Black people to talk to powerful people who are not as compromised as it seems as though a lot of our Black leadership is. You know, the same things after you do your Googles on Al Sharpton, I implore you to do your same Googles on Roland Martin, a despised person within young Black people. So when you see young Black people talking about politics on the internet, and you look at Roland Martin, when you look at Al Sharpton, they are collectively upset with them. And I think we're seeing the results of those things. And I think, you know, we talk about this all the time. I'm like, I think there needs to be a 50-year-old, 40-year-old, 30-year-old, 20-year-old teenage come hither, because we're not all collectively motivated or trusting of the same Black people. And I think it's eroding our own political power as Black people. So, I wanted to bring this to the podcast, not because I had any miraculous thoughts, but I just thought it was a subject matter that it would be valuable for us to dig into and to think about, specifically because there's so many. How many Black people do you know who are spiritual but not religious? How many Black people do you know who, if not their own, are not queer or trans or something like that themselves, but really, really care about those things or really care about feminist ideas now because of how it's kind of got into our culture and got into pop culture? How do we talk to those people to make it feel like, okay, there is a cultural space that is safe and also neutral, so you can actually push back and something does happen and not just keep the same people in power? I think a lot of that Charlamagne interview, even though I loved it, I think a lot of that was like, why are you talking to our communal jester and not talking to our communal kings? Why are you talking to people who are why are you not just talking to, we would rather you see you talk to 100 podcasters who have under 100,000 followers than talk to one Charlamagne. Maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's just the answer, just going to everybody's own personal digitally made third space, and that's how you touch everybody. Or maybe there's actually something physical and brick and mortar we can erect that is replacement of it. But I do think we have to think about it, because you just can't deny the reality that we're in and the results that we're seeing. And we see the results when Black people are not motivated. That's what Barack Obama was trying to do during that time, was motivate Black people to be as motivated as they were when he was running for office. And that just did not work. That image, that idea, the civil rights era, that Black elite, that Black excellence veneer is just so bad for some Black people, you know? So I wanted to know what you all think and how you all feel, and if there's any, maybe some good ideas that come out of this conversation. Now I feel like I should be calling on people. I'm like, I was literally going to say, Kaya, DeRay, any?
I mean, you said a lot. I think maybe, and I could say a lot about the Black church, as somebody who was churched growing up, went to Sunday school and church every Sunday, was in the Buds of Promise, sang in the junior choir, did all the things, and was pretty well churched into my adulthood, and now find myself kind of church optional. I like it. I enjoy it, but it doesn't hold the centrality in my life that it once did. And I think I'm just going to make it a little bit broader and say, I think that this, the quote unquote decline of the Black church, is actually indicative of the decline in civil society, civil institutions, right? It's not just the Black church. Lots of churches are seeing declines in participation, social groups. And it's so interesting to watch at a time where we are lonelier than we ever have been. We are also eschewing many of the vehicles for building community.
Yes.
And I think that part of that is because of social media, where we think we have community in these online spaces, and we don't have to leave our house. We don't have to go to a meeting. We don't have to go to a gathering or whatever, whatever. And I think the pandemic exacerbated this lack of gathering. Even like, you know, young people don't go to malls on Saturdays and see each other and interact. And so I think that This is just indicative of a breakdown of what I would call sort of in-person social communities that have been critical to our like thriving as human beings. Like, we are social creatures. We need to be engaged with one another. And I think that, I think about the fact that I've been working from home for the last 8 years and just started a job where I go back into the office, and I love it. I love being in the office. I get work done differently. I'm much more productive. And it reminds me that we are social creatures, as much as I like to be home on Mondays and Fridays. But I think that for Black people, the church was not only a gathering and a community building place. It was not only a salve and a balm for the balm, for the, you know, atrocities and violence that we faced out in the world every day, but it was also a political organizing institution. And so even if we've decided that we don't need that community or we have other ways to ease our collective pain, the political function of the Black church is lost. And I do think that the sort of humanizing social fabric is lost as well. And again, I think that's not just for this community. I think that this is for a lot of communities. It tracks with people's distrust of institutions that I think the media has done a very good job of undermining our belief in all kinds of institutions. And I'm not really sure what the antidote is, but I will tell you one thing that sort of came up in the news for me this week that was shocking to me was in Australia, they've banned the use of social media for anybody under 16. And one of the things that I wondered is, okay, those kids are going to have to go somewhere and see each other and talk to each other. Those people are going to have to rebuild groups that where like-minded people come together around an interest or an idea and whatnot. And I ultimately think that that nation will be stronger because they are rebuilding the social bonds and taking technology out of the forefront. And I wondered if that could ever happen in the United States of America. And I think the answer is no. But I do wonder what makes us go back to the ties that bind us, the institutions that connect us, the opportunities that give us a chance to make common good. And I think because we aren't doing that, it is easy to be divided and manipulated by people. And I don't know how this ends.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's interesting. The last big research that has been done on Black people and religiosity is that Black people are more religious than other subgroups of Americans, and church attendance is decreasing by generation amongst Black people. So, like, that makes sense. I do think, and I think about this with the Catholic Church, I think about this with the Black Church, is that there is either there was a willful ignorance around things that were not right. So, like, I think the Catholic Church and the sex scandals, I think while in Baltimore, they're closing, I think, 20 churches. And Baltimore is only, but, you know, Maryland is only but so big. So closing 20 actual, like, shutting down congregations, stuff like that, because of the settlements with the sex abuse cases, they just don't have the money to keep anymore. But, you know, that happened for a long time and they ignored it. And the consequences of it are, like, people are like, I don't trust. I think about the Boy Scouts too. You're like, why would I go to this thing where you preach a moral message and you cover immoral things, right? So, like, I think that is what happened to them. And I think the Black church, I will never forget the last time I actively went to church. It was in Baltimore. I used to go to church all the time. And I think there's a huge benefit in, like, the fact that we all know the hymns and the, you know, there's a thing about it. And I think it was one of the few places in Black life where all the generations came together. There was a reinforcement of norms. And every week we got a message that was somewhat political and a reminder that, like, even though the world is hard, you still got it. The last sermon I ever sat through was in Baltimore, in the west side of Baltimore. I'll never forget it. And he was so homophobic. And I wasn't, like, out yet. Like, I was sort of just, like, trying to figure myself out. But I just remember being like, wow, that was really homophobic. And I was like, why would I ever sit through, like, I couldn't just walk out in the middle. So I had to, like, sit through all of it because I was, you know, that it wouldn't have been socially acceptable to just walk out. But I'm like, yeah, I will never, ever, like, subject myself to this sort of thing again. Like, I'm not, that was the last time I've ever, like, actually been a member. And y'all remember, it's like your first time going, you stand up as a visitor, like, walked. And I was like, yeah, I'm not doing this no more. And I think that is a lot of people's stories where it's like, I believe in it. I want to do it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not subjecting myself. But their church is coming around now, but I do think they missed the tide. And to your point, Miles, I think they still have a stronghold on the older generation, and the data shows that. But there are young people, and to your point, Kaya, I do think that the parasocial relationships have really hoodwinked people. That, like, you know, and I think it's exacerbated by capitalism, that it is not simply parasocial, but there's an incentive to participate in the parasocial. It's Kai Cenat, you know, he had 700,000 subscribers. He broke the Twitch record, and the lowest cost to subscribe is $5. That's a lot of money to watch this kid just play on Twitch, you know? Or you think about, like, Twitter, Instagram, it is incentivized. You can make real money by pretending that you're people's friends and they have a relationship with you online. That is a very interesting sort of dynamic that I think that we will only continue to see the consequences of. And the last thing I'll say that is hopeful, I think people are hungry for offline spaces. I think about, like, people want to get together. They want to do stuff. Quality sometimes be damned, because I've gone to stuff where I'm like, what is going on? But people just want to be together. And I do think that the people who will have the new type of power will be the organizers of people in real life, whether it is, like, parties or, like, the run clubs or the, you know, I don't know if y'all seen on Instagram, the dad clubs where the dads, like, take all the kids to, like, Chuck E. Cheese. Like, I think that people are, like, wanting to be in community, and the barrier for entry to being one of those organizers is lower than it's ever been. It used to be like, you know, I'm an organizer, whereas now it's like, hey, get your friends together, go outside and make a thing. And I think that that's coming back.
Yeah, Miles, thank you, because my mom and I actually listened to Lil Bill, who I now am a subscriber to, when we were running our errands yesterday. And so there's so many layers of this conversation. So one, obviously, it's like sort of where people are getting their information from, which we're seeing, and through your education, Miles, is more and more through YouTube and these sort of independent sort of sources, which always, and I'm also listening like on Audible to Ta-Nehisi's The Message. So it's so interesting. I went back between Lil Bill and Ta-Nehisi, like they actually need to have a podcast together because that would be fabulous. But, you know, I think the root of what we're all talking about, particularly for Black folks, is sort of finding spaces to convene in physically, to Kaya's point around folks being lonelier than ever. Like, I think these are, and I think a lot of these conversations sort of came out of this election too, sort of like the work we need to do as a community, whether that's on mental health, whether that's connectedness, whether that's addressing homophobia, transphobia. Like, there's so much work for us to do as a community. Now, I do think that the Black church, that's like an institution, like that's actually like a discipline for us to study. I think there are sort of spiritual places, like my church in DC, Unity Church, is a non-denominational church ran by an incredible Black woman, Reverend Sylvia. And then Middle Church in New York, which is ran by Reverend Jackie Lewis. Like, there are actually inclusive, beautiful places where a lot of this can be worked out spiritually, metaphysically, which I just wanted to note that. On the sort of political election side and how this ties into how folks show up at the polls, I think that's something that needs to be clearly be addressed in a huge way. I was having a conversation with a friend who's in Georgia politics a couple days ago. And she said to me, she said, you know, she's like, guess how many people voted, just how many people showed up to the polls for the last Atlanta mayor's race? And I was like, I don't know, like a couple million. Like, there's got to be what, like 8 or 10 million people in Atlanta. 96,000. So to become mayor of Atlanta, you need probably what, 900,000 less followers than DeRay has. You know what I'm saying? That I probably didn't say that, but it's like DeRay actually, we collectively could be mayor three times over in Atlanta just with our social followings. You know what I mean? Like, that is, and we actually need to take these things seriously. And I don't think we do enough, because I think the folks that understand them are the folks that are sort of the Al Sharptons and the consultants of the world that know how these political levers work. Like, I don't even know how this stuff works, because I'm not a corrupt person in these politics. Like, I'm always like, that can't be right. And I'm like, wait, what did they do? No. So there's so much going on here, and I hope we continue to sort of, like, I love actually this sort of construction of the format you're bringing, Miles, because I think so many things we talk about in an interconnected way. And I think it's so sort of smart and elevating that we do that. And hopefully, as we start to continue to distill and explore, that we will get to some sort of solutions. But I think even the approach is a good start for how we talk about these things.
I wanted to say something really briefly to DeRay's point, because it was really good. And DeRay, the video that I provided from Little Bill, it actually is a critique of the film Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul, which stars Regina King and that fine Black man, Sterling K. Brown. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's both of them. And inside of it, it really dissects Sterling K. Brown having just sexual, like homosexual sexual abuse, and Regina King being in relationship with him, despite that, but they're both being like these owners of this mega church. So it really is like that film in itself is a critique of kind of like where exactly you were going with everything. So I do think that, and then to your point, Diarra, I actually was thinking on the other end, as much people can't see this, but I have African masks behind me. I'm just a big spiritual, Black spiritual person. But I was like, we need Black atheist spaces. I think actually us coming together based off of belief in spirituality and hope, I think that has expired. And I think whether it be digital or not, we need more Black atheist spaces. I think that's why Hassan Piker, who's deeply political and intellectual, and I never heard them speak about anything that's spiritual or anything like that, has really captivated so many people. And he's a streamer. I think that Black people, I think we have to kind of, I don't want to say grow out of it, but accept that maybe we need a place where that's not moralized, that's not spiritualized, for us to come together. And maybe we can have better movement when it's not based off of that, as antithetical to our mindset as can be. That is just where my impulse is going. And I think we can't overestimate how lonely people are. So to DeRay's point again about the running groups and all these people who want to be together, that is great. And I totally agree with DeRay. I think that's definitely happening. But also there's a deep loneliness in a deep incel community that of young, like, I'm talking about young men who are afraid to speak to people. We're talking about people who are so addicted to convenience that talking to certain people publicly or being outside or being in community with somebody brings them anxiety, because we have a whole generation who went through COVID, who has convenience, who only knows digital, who is a deep fear. So I also think it's about people who are extroverted, people who are older, who remember playing outside. I think it's about us building those places too and dragging some people out as well, because I think the people who are already motivated to participate to what DeRay named, we're always going to participate. And I think there's a whole other group of people, specifically Black folks, who are totally lost, totally abandoned, totally lonely, who may not be motivated by themselves. Thank y'all for sharing y'all
thoughts. I think that's right, Miles, but I also think, like, I think we also don't have to, like, when we say spirituality, it doesn't have to be through sort of a religiosity.
Absolutely,
like,
agree.
I think I don't think we do enough as Black folks to get to sort of our roots around, you know, sort of indigenous. This is also from a very personal place, because I was, you know, been in an 8-year relationship with an atheist. And so maybe I can be a part of the pool to sort of pull Miles, pull those convenings together. I have a lot of experience there. But I think, and that's why I think it's important for us to not sort of define spirituality through these sort of, like, Western constructs, because spirituality is really just about self-awareness, self-reflection, and then also your ability to be able to empathize and sort of see others, right? And so I think, and also just, like, and for me, a step further is actually, like, your relationship with, like, the earth and animals and the, like, so I guess it's just a redefining of how we're talking about spirituality, so that it does have more of an inclusive pull. And so it doesn't imbibe some of these other things that are sort of triggers for so many folks, which is understandable. And Miles, I completely hear and feel you, but I also don't want to sort of do away with so much of what we need to get back to, and what should just have been done better. And there's sort of decades of practice into it. And, like, how can we pull the things that actually have not been corrupted from that?
I'll go to my news, but just as a clarification on the numbers, DR, for Atlanta, your point remains. There are 500,000 people in Atlanta, and the mayor of Atlanta in the 2021 runoff won with 50,000 votes. So your general point, just tweaking the numbers a little bit, but the general point remains that 500,000 residents, it took 50,000 votes for him to win, and only 78,000 people voted. So it is much, it doesn't take a lot. In Baltimore, it's like 2,000, 3,000 votes to be on the city council, which is really crazy.
It's a wild thing.
It's crazy. Wow.
Anyway.
My news is about prison. So in Virginia, there's a notoriously bad prison in Western Virginia called the Red Onion State Prison. I want to shout out local journalists from Prison Radio, which is a, like, not mainstream outlet that covers prisons and jails. And they've been around for 30 years, independent production studio that does radio, TV, film, host of things. And they have been highlighting a lot of issues that people have not been for a long time. But what they did highlight that has become really public now is that in the Red Onion jail, people have been putting themselves on fire with the hopes of being removed from the prison to another facility, that the conditions are just so bad that in a 2018 lawsuit, one man hallucinated and said he spoke to his dead parents because he was in solitary for more than 12 years. Another guy was isolated for more than 600 days. He started to speak in numbers, lost more than 30 pounds, forgot how to spell his name. The Department of Corrections just settled the lawsuits that their families filed. And in response to the conditions, the governor's office has created an ombudsman's position within the Office of Inspector General to monitor prison conditions. But again, the short version is that the conditions are so bad that people are setting themselves on fire with the hope that they have to get moved from the facility. So just to name, that's wild that, you know, the punishment of incarceration is separation from society. And the idea that when people are incarcerated, that we torture them is just unreal. Incarceration enough is torture. So I had not heard of this prison before this news became a news on Twitter. I'm happy that mainstream, like The Appeal, actually picked it up, because there are a lot of these stories that get surfaced in independent media that covers prisons and jails and never gets picked up by anybody and gets, frankly, ignored unless advocates sort of yell about it. The other thing is that when we think about the solution, Maryland actually, in the same vein as the ombudsman position, Maryland actually did the same thing. And the challenge with these positions is that they have no power. So what they can do is that they can go visit any place, they can monitor any place, they have free rein to go to facilities and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, all they can do is make recommendations to either the Department of Corrections or to the governor. And while that is interesting, I'm not really sure I call that actual oversight. So the Virginia law that passed makes this whole, you know, when you read the law, they can go investigate and write reports and da-da-da. And at the end, the only power they have is actually to make recommendations. And I do think that when we start thinking about oversight, we actually have to like nail the power part of oversight as opposed to just creating these bodies that give recommendations that don't frankly have to be contended with. So it's not even like, you know, they can force hearings or I don't know, like they really can just make recommendations. And I don't think that that is enough. Like when you read the law, it literally says the ombudsman shall have the authority to make recommendations to the state inspector general to hire staff, secure office space, contract with experts as necessary. And you're like, that is not, I don't think that's oversight. I don't know what that is. That's interesting. I don't think that's oversight. So I wanted to bring it here because this was fascinating to me and one of the few stories that we see rise up to national media.
Thank you for bringing this to the podcast, DeRay. Like, of course it's sad, right? Of course it's depressing, but I think that my mind automatically goes to the piece that you were that the comment that you made, even around the media and how it's like finally like how this story has infiltrated the mainstream media, and how that's and how that's worked. I'm really just, I guess, I don't know what the word is, maybe disappointed. I'm probably disappointed that there is not a more robust ecosystem to engineer this being a story, you know, like, and engineer it. Because I think we do have enough people on the left who care about these subject matters, who care about what's going on with these people. You know, that's a cry for help. If somebody's setting themselves on fire to get out of jail, that's a cry for help. And we have the data, the cultural memory of Vietnam. You can't watch a Vietnam documentary without somebody saying, you know, American scene, what was happening in Vietnam changed the feeling for Vietnam and changed people's perspective on it. And I'm like, yeah, we have to create our own ecosystems that engineer this being in front of people's faces. And we have people who are capturing enough attention from different pockets of people to engineer this being a viral story if we wanted it to. So we don't have to lean on the appeal. And I think if there's nothing else, I think it's situations like this that feel ripe for those moments, because it's not a whole lot of talking about. There's not a whole lot of maybe this, maybe that. The story that I remember, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 podcasts, I don't know, child, about the men... the police officer men coming into the house and torturing that black man in Mississippi. Like, to me, those are the type of stories where I'm obsessed with Olay. She's so pretty and she's so smart. But like I'm like, who's calling Olay, Little Bill, FD Signifier, Julesy? Like, these are all people who I'm like, I feel like if you said, hey, can we get this story on, or is there a way that we can get people paid to maybe like to infiltrate it or to collaborate with them? It's there. And I'm like, if we can keep the momentum of people knowing that this is happening and that people are being tortured and this stuff is happening, then it won't be this big 4-3.5 year amnesia about where the status of the world is. And all you can remember it. I don't even want to get into that. There won't be this a big amnesia around where the status of this world is if we keep on reminding people that right underneath their comfortable feet, or right underneath their own worries or their uncomfortable feet, are people who are being tortured, exploited, who are setting themselves on fire to escape their situations in America. I think that is riveting, and I think it's awakening, and I think we can engineer more people being awakened by that information if we were just a little bit more organized. So that's the only generative thing that I can say about this that does not sound like gloomy and doom. But thank you, for as usual, for keeping us aware of what's happening in this kind of like invisible minority that is imprisoned people.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like there was a documentary about this prison, Duray, done in like 2017, so we can sort of learn more. And I think this, and maybe it's just my brain, but this is why I get so upset about the Hunter Biden stuff. It's just like, this is what we have going on. And this is a part of our criminal legal system. And what a shame.
Yeah, it's totally true. It's totally true. But the trans issue, right? The trans jail people being transitioned in jail issue. That was engineered. They took I remember texting DeRay in the podcast, yep, being like, how many people, can you tell me the number of people this happened to? And DeRay's like, I think the answer was like 3. Like, I was like, I'm like, oh, this is, you picked it, you engineered it, you made it go viral. Let's do the same thing with righteous causes, because And it's the best of times and worst of times for it being a free-for-all for what we want to make news and go viral.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, after today's episode, thank goodness for some uplifting news. I saw Wicked last night. I went with my little brother and one of his good friends, and it was glorious. Absolutely glorious. Cynthia and Revo. My dear, she was spectacular. And it's so interesting watching this film at this moment, because obviously I so desperately like need wins. And Ariana Grande was also incredible. You want to murder her basically the entire film. She does an excellent job at sort of playing like just classic blonde mean girl. So she was excellent as well. But there's so many things that I'm still processing from all of this. And just sort of, you know, and for y'all that there's no spoiler alert. It's like, it's Wicked. We all know it is. It's basically the story of the origin of the Wicked Witch of the West and how she became evil. And what this film does is sort of show us like, you know, how the powers that be can sort of orchestrate sort of cultural norms and language and identity to create this sort of narrative about an individual. In this case, it was Elphaba, who is the Wicked Witch of the West. What was brilliant about this film is sort of the layering of complex issues that I think, depending if you are seeing the movie as a Black woman, who from the very beginning of the movie, you're already rolling your eyes and rolling your neck because you're like, see, here we go. We're already, it's 30 seconds in the movie. We're already mad. But by the end, it is just like this sort of transformational sort of manifestation of Black girl magic. And Cynthia just pulls it off so beautifully. And so I want to encourage everyone to go see it. The theater was packed. I will say it's so interesting being a Black person in a theater with white people. I don't know why white people are so adverse to, like, I mean, at the end of the movie, I was shouting, clapping, all the things, because I just was like, oh my God, this is like, we have ascended. And everyone else is just like quiet in their seats being like, oh, here they go again. So that's always an interesting thing. So we need to screen this. We need to do a Campaign Zero screening, DeRay, so I can be with my people when we do this. Okay. Because it's a completely different experience. But those are my thoughts. I encourage you all to see it so we can have an even deeper conversation about it. But it was absolutely beautiful.
Diara, I love that you say her name so Black and so wrong. Cynthia Erivo just made my heart smile. That woman's
name
is Cynthia Erivo. But Erivo is great. I love it. It's so auntie that I actually love it because it came out of a place of love. That made me smile. You know, the right hates the movie because they think it is too woke and they are like, you know, this is an attack and blah, blah, blah. So it's been interesting to see their critiques of it. Granted, the thing is 20 years old. This is not a new story. But did you know, DR, and Miles, you haven't seen it yet, right?
I haven't, no.
Have you seen it on Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you just haven't seen it.
Yes,
you
know, mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you know that I think in the history of this on Broadway, there's only been one full-time Black Elphaba? So there have been some understudies and some standbys, but there's only actually been one casted full-time Black Elphaba in the history of this play on Broadway. And that is wild to me.
Whoa.
So I thought that was interesting. So it's made Cynthia being Black even more special because there's only been one Black full-time. There have been, if you look it up, you'll see some of the women who did play Elphaba, and they were understudies or they were on tour and got to be in the role. But on Broadway, I think there has been one again.
That's wild. I want to give like a little like weird Wicked themed shout out to my boyfriend's bestie, Kimber Sprawl, who played Essa Rose in the Broadway show. She's now going to be, she just announced, I want to get her on the podcast to interview her because she's going to be on stage with Denzel Washington in Othello. So I would love to speak to her about Shakespeare and for the podcast. But I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm really excited. But one thing I will offer that's been really interesting to witness culturally is Cynthia is not the most liked Black person, and I always, culturally, when I see like kind of like the temperature around her, she's not the most liked Black person. I think that's for a lot of different reasons. I think that she's done things, taken roles that people have really had, like her taking the Harriet Tubman role and the Aretha Franklin role. I think a lot of Black Americans really feel offended that she was this British young woman who took these Black American roles. I also think that she is a dark-skinned woman. I think she has short hair. I think that she has a queer aesthetic that is not for the male gaze, that really unsettles people, both subconsciously and consciously. But what's been interesting about seeing her on this kind of campaign or whatever is that I think we found the upside of all these big IPs because it seems to totally have insulated her. It has not tanked the Wicked ship. She is still, people still have gone to see it. I don't know what the box office numbers like the final ones, but I know they're huge. Yeah,
and
I know
that they. And folks are also mad, Miles, just quickly interrupt you, because they thought Joker with Lady Gaga and whoever else was going to completely overshadow Wicked. And hello, Joker who?
Yeah, they were delusional when it came to that.
This is the highest grossing musical to film adaptation in history. It surpassed Grease, which had held the title up until Wicked. And remember that Nessa Rose, all of us have seen the play at least. The actress who plays Nessa Rose in the movie is disabled. And she is the first disabled woman to play Nessa Rose.
Okay.
Also disabled.
Okay.
So I really appreciate what they did in the film. I thought it was also fascinating that they actually built those sets. So it was not CGI for a lot of that. Those were like actual sets. So like the train to the Emerald City actually exists. And did I remember that the story, just like the play, is in two parts. When you go see it in real life, there's an intermission. But in the movie, we get the second one in November of 2025. They've already filmed the second one. It is done. It's just not coming out for
another
year.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah, and they talk about a marketing budget, because whoever did the marketing on this team, baby, hire them. If you got the money, hire them to tell your story.
Right.
Because Wicked, I thought Adele's comment about Wicked was great. She was like, I don't like musicals, but the marketing for this was so good that even I got to go see it. You're like, girl, yes, because they have hotel collabs, Starbucks, Airbnb, like movie theaters. I'm like, they have really, and you know what also did really well? I think Moana is now the highest. Yeah. Moana 2 is the highest grossing animated film in history. Oh, I didn't see Moana 1. I sort of missed the Moana craze, but I'm actually going to go see one, and I'm going to watch one and go see 2, because people have been raving about what a beautiful story 2 is as well.
And to your point, DeRay, around the marketing, I found the marketing so interesting, the subtle marketing. So when you go on, I'm obsessed with YouTube and Instagram and influencer and all that other stuff, the subtle marketing of, okay, we're going to pay this influencer, talk about anything Wizard of Oz themed. So you have these 2-hour deep dives into Wizard of Oz or into Shirley Temple almost being cast as Julie Garland. So you have these big sweeping moments of like pink and green, and you're like, okay, it's Wicked time. But also there's these like little smart things they did just to get the taste and temperature to the right dial for Wicked, which I think was really interesting. And just to put a pin in my initial thought, I think that Cynthia being so insulated from maybe people's distaste for her is good news for people who just want to sing and act and not want to be likable and be a celebrity, showing that, oh, I don't have to be the most popular or the most liked person in order to not tank a movie. I think that might be a positive on this kind of death of the movie star that we've been seeing.
One last thing. The Wiz is still, hands down, the best at all of this stuff. So thank you, Quincy Jones.
Last week on Pod Save the World, Tommy and Ben dug into the latest on the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Listen to it, you'll learn a lot. Then they sat down with Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala. She's a global icon for girls' education, and she survived a Taliban attack in 2012. And in this interview, they talk about what happened when the Taliban retook Afghanistan in 2021, and she talks about a new documentary, Bread and Roses. Listen to Pod Save the World wherever you get your podcasts, or watch the full interview on YouTube.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.